Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with your politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So
like
you could just see
600,000 deducted. So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor. Every tax check I had written, and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes. I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you're finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this, because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last try. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it, just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had number shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what happened is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
The only two things in life that make it worth living is guitars that tune good and firm feeling women. I don't need my name in the marquee lights. I got my song and I got you with me tonight. Maybe it's time we got back to the basics of love. Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas. Waylon and Willie and the boys. This successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys. Between Hank Williams' pain songs and Lou Berry's train songs and blue eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, nobody feeling no pain. So baby, let's sell your diamond ring, buy some boots and faded jeans and go away. This coat and tie is choking me. In your high society you cry all day. Been so busy keeping up with the Joneses, four car garage, and we're still building up. Maybe in time we got back to the basics of love. Let's go to Lukenbach, Texas, Waylon and Willie and the boys. This successful life we're living got us feuding like the Hatfields and McCoys. Between Hank Williams' pain songs and Newberry's train songs and blue eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, ain't nobody feeling no pain.
Texas, William Whalen and boys. This successful life we're living, got us feuding like the Hatfields and the Coys. Between the Hank Williams pain songs and Jerry Jeff train songs and blue eyes crying in the rain. Out in Lukenbach, Texas, there ain't nobody feeling no pain.
E-commerce develops rapidly in China. It demonstrates that the transition from physical to digital commerce, often perceived as a phenomenon of high-income countries, can happen in a country at a lower level of development as well. The World Bank and the Alibaba Group launched a joint research initiative to examine how China has harnessed digital technologies to aid growth and expand employment opportunities through e-commerce development in rural areas. Taobao villages are villages significantly engaged in e-commerce, with total annual e-commerce transaction volume of at least RMB 10 million, with at least 100 active online shops. The number of Taobao villages increased from 20 in 2013 to 1,311 in 2016 and to 2,118 in 2017. The World Bank Alibaba Joint Research Team, in collaboration with Peking University, conducted a survey in rural China covering 1,400 households and 80 Taobao villages significantly engaged in e-commerce. The analysis finds that rural areas with good infrastructure and good access to markets tend to be most conducive to e-commerce. More than half of people in Taobao villages use internet. People with higher education are more likely to use internet, particularly for work and learning-related activities. The internet penetrates people's lives with news, entertainment, online shopping, work, and education. Most people, especially e-households in Taobao villages, perceive their social status as equal or higher compared with 5 years ago, and they believe they have equal or even higher social status 2 years in the future. E-households are richer than other households. Business income, including e-commerce income, is the main income source of e-households. E-shop owners are younger and more educated than the rest of the population in the village. Many e-shop owners are returned migrants and women. Most e-shops are small. E-shop workers in Taobao villages have wage levels equal to or higher than workers in urban private industries. High cost of online advertisement, tough competition, and lack of skills are considered by e-shop owners the top three obstacles to developing e-commerce. Access to finance remained an important constraint. The majority of e-households have never borrowed for operations or only borrowed from household members, friends, and relatives. For those who borrowed, Ant Financial, followed by banks and other financing platforms, are important sources of financing. Many anecdotal cases show that e-commerce play a positive role in people's lives. The future research agenda includes how can e-commerce development be furthered as an instrument for poverty reduction and shared prosperity? How can the lessons of rural China be used to inspire other countries to seek unconventional solutions and a wider set of partners to tackle persistent challenges?
My name is James Robson, and I'm the Victor and William Fung Director of the Harvard Asia Center. I'd like to welcome you to the Asia Center's Research Talk Series. The research talks are aimed at showcasing some of the fascinating research that's being done on various facets of Asia by Harvard students, graduate students, faculty, Asia Center affiliates, and other specialists. We very much hope you enjoyed learning from these talks.
Hi, everybody. My broad interest is on entrepreneurship and what impact it can have on growth and inequality, which naturally means my curiosity is much more on developing countries and specifically on China. My more recent research curiosity is essentially to inquire on what role can technology play in promoting grassroots type of entrepreneurship for growth and development. One of the most promising areas of interest in entrepreneurship is that of entrepreneurial ecosystems. It holds interest not only for academics, but also from policymakers because of the promise that entrepreneurial ecosystems hold for promoting a dynamic, sustainable economic growth. An entrepreneurial ecosystem comprises of individual elements which combine and interact in complex ways, and together these elements turbocharge venture creation and growth. With their promise of growth and job creation, naturally, entrepreneurial ecosystems have attracted the attention of government and local authorities worldwide, and it enjoys a huge amount of public support. My current research addresses two concerns within the field of entrepreneurial ecosystems. First, I try to address a general bias in the entrepreneurship literature given its focus, its Western-centric focus. This is true not only for entrepreneurship in general, but also for entrepreneurial ecosystems, which has largely held up a Silicon Valley type of growth as its model. Recently, authors have stressed the importance of studying entrepreneurship phenomenon in emerging countries, and as it is one of the most understudied but important global economic phenomenon today. Second, technology has become one of the threads from which the fabric of organization is now woven. And while digital technologies are shaping entrepreneurial opportunities, decisions, actions, and outcome, the question is, what role does it play in promoting entrepreneurial ecosystems? The phenomenon that I focus now in my ongoing research is that of Taobao villages in China. With the accelerated penetration of high-speed internet in rural China, a new and distinct entrepreneurial phenomenon has risen from within rural China, which is largely considered or baptized as the Taobao villages. The exponential growth of China's e-commerce has enabled the Chinese not only to buy online, but platforms like Taobao.com, which is owned by Alibaba, have also created new opportunities for entrepreneurs and small firms to sell their products and often services online. Opening up an online store entails no fees, nor do platforms take any cuts from the online transactions, unlike, for example, Amazon. Rural Chinese have leveraged this digital phenomenon to sell, and thus the phenomenon of Taobao villages have quickly flourished. Ali Research, the Taobao arm of Alibaba Group, considers Taobao villages as those where at least 10% of the households in a village engage in e-commerce and have annual online sales of at least 10 million yuan, which is approximately $1.5 million. The concept of Taobao villages first appeared about 12 years back when it was decided what criteria has to be met. Soon, entrepreneurs, mostly farmers, leveraged their technology to sell their products online. Taobao villages quickly diffused across the country. The Taobao villages exploited economies of agglomeration, and sellers from Taobao villages became even more competitive on e-commerce platforms. An associated phenomenon is that of Taobao towns, which quickly emerged, which is a township or street that consists of at least three such Taobao villages, a larger agglomeration of Taobao towns from the Taobao village clusters. When there exists a cluster of more than 10 neighboring Taobao villages that together practice e-commerce, and entrepreneurs leverage the Taobao Alibaba platform to sell their products and services. So this phenomenon, which is about 12 years or 13 years old, has having a transformative effect in rural China. The number of Taobao villages and Taobao towns in China rose to more than 5,400 from about 1,756, about 20-25% over the previous years. China's one village, one product policy, ongoing since 2007, had earlier laid the foundations of specialization, encouraging every village to develop locally distinguishable products. This story can be traced, the phenomenon of Taobao villages can be traced down to one village, the Dongwang village in Shaji town, which was the first rural village to take up e-commerce on a large scale. Shaji is a small town of a population of about 50,000, located in Jiangsu province. In 2010, the Alibaba research team was surprised when a large dot showed up in their visualization map, which showed a strong e-commerce activity. They went down to verify, and they found a very interesting phenomenon. But it started with just one entrepreneur, a Shaji native, San Han, left his village to study and ended up working on several jobs before deciding to come back to his hometown. In 2006, he bought a computer and opened the first online Taobao shop in the town, reselling mobile phone accessories, which were sourced from his friends he had made in Guangzhou. Although the business was not going so well, he became inspired from a visit to an IKEA store in Shanghai, where flat pack furniture was becoming popular among the emerging middle class in China. He bought a few pieces and brought them back to Shaji. He then worked with local carpenters to craft their own furniture versions and put them on sale in his Taobao shop. In a very short period of time, sales boomed, requiring him to hire other villages. Inspired by their success, other villages imitated, and eventually they started opening up their own e-commerce stores, mostly based on furniture. There are many such examples showing how e-commerce has allowed locals to build their own profitable business. For example, Mrs. Kai, also from Shaji, a peasant in a poor village, she became a restaurant owner in just 10 years, a very successful one at that. This was possible due to the engagement in e-commerce for furniture, which she got through a cousin. She worked with other people before she opened up her own Taobao store. Her business grew to have 30 employees and about millions of RMB in revenue. She was unable to buy two houses to allow her son to have a good education and open up her own restaurant. This is just one of thousands of examples spread throughout rural China, where the abundance of open technology platforms and collaborations among villagers are changing the lives of millions. So what's happening? One person, then neighbors, then the whole village, and then a cluster of villages and towns. Alibaba and Taobao are changing rural China the ways many of us do not know. It's a bottom-up model. In entrepreneurial ecosystems, we speak about the strong role of the government, where the government is a promoter. This is not the case. It's these small entrepreneurs from rural villages who are selling, often using live stream, to promote their goods and services. Second, it's an emergence of an ecosystem of varied actors for delivery, website creation, packaging, logistics, and so on. Third, there are low barriers and inspiration is taken and not just imitation, which follows a certain pattern, and very soon villages start to specialize. Fourth, the government's role here is as a facilitator of providing good quality infrastructure, roads, electricity, telecoms, and so on. Fifth, with the annual transaction volume of Taobao villages and Taobao town onlines exceeding RMB 1 trillion, more migrant workers are returning to their hometown to start their own businesses. Sixth, with close to 3 million online stores creating over 8.2 million jobs, it's transforming rural villages. More than 50% of Taobao villages are located in western and central China, where much of the poorer people in China live. Seventh, the wide coverage of digital infrastructure has made available new jobs and entrepreneurship opportunities for marginalized people in remote mountainous areas during the pandemic. This is a work in progress. I have collected quite a lot of information and data via secondary sources and some interviews. Unfortunately, due to the pandemic, I have not been able to visit many more villages than I want to. Hopefully, when China opens up for tourists and researchers, my work will continue next year. And it's a work in progress. And I like to show through my research how entrepreneurial ecosystems are transforming the lives of poor people in ways nobody would have imagined. And digital infrastructure provided the affordance for such a transformation. Thank you so much.
You mentioned Taobao a couple of times too. So tell us a little bit about that and how they came to be and how Alibaba played a part in that.
Well, so Taobao was really the retail e-commerce arm of Alibaba Group. And it was started initially because of the fear that, eBay, if they came into the China market, they would really not only take the consumer marketplace, but they might actually move into other areas that were competitive with Alibaba Group. More importantly was the realization that the Chinese consumers did not have access to products that the rest of the world did because they had such a rudimentary retail, like I talked about earlier, infrastructure system. So I think a big driver too, beyond just the competitive aspects, was that consumers in China had curiosity and desire to access products from all over the world, but they weren't able to do that through the traditional means. So how do we actually give them access to that through the internet? And one of the things that people always talk about at eBay is that they had 95% market share at the time that Taobao got started. That's true if you look at the addressable market that was already online and already purchasing products. But if you look at the addressable market, which was 90, so that's probably like 3 to 4 million, I guess, at that time. But if you look at the addressable market that was already online in, say, 2003, 2004, it was like 90 million, okay? And you could say, well, that's the market that we're trying to address and provide them access to these products. But if you take a step back further and say, no, actually the addressable market is not just those who are online, but actually the entire sort of retail market, that was at the time like 700-800 million. And so what Taobao really thought about is how do we serve this 700-800 million people that want access to all these products but don't know how to find it? That's what we're creating for them. And that marketing approach was dramatically different from what you would do if you were like just competing with eBay. We actually used the same process we did with B2B, educate the market
through very traditional means. Like we'd have seminars, we'd do a lot of offline stuff to kind of educate the normal Chinese consumer that Taobao is the place to find anything from anywhere. And you can do that all through your internet. You know. So in a way, we drove the adoption and the use of the internet for retail consumption.
How is it doing today?
Oh, so today it's like over a billion users and over $1 trillion in gross merchandise value. So it's by far the largest in the world. And that, again, is the result of kind of this evolution of this ecosystem that Alibaba Group really helped to catalyze.
You must be familiar with Taobao, Chinese online shopping website and one of the largest e-commerce websites in the world. But do you know Taobao Village? Who are the merchants? What do they sell? And how do they sell? Now I'm in Xichenbo Village, one of the Taobao villages in Suning County, and they're selling fishing gears.
因为我们这个镇本身就是有做玉根的这个传统的这个产业，所以呢，当时我们就选取了玉根。当时呢，因为我们家2012年做了之后呢，当时开了一个店铺，接着呢两个三个，那生意做好了之后呢，那需要的人也就多了，所以说我们附近的这些村民呢，我就叫过他们来，来给帮忙了，一个是收入比他种地还多呢。
Live streaming. Actually, I'm not surprised to see this in Taobao Village since it has played such an important role in e-commerce, especially during the epidemic. Can I have a try? According to the Alibaba Research Institute, a Taobao village is one that has annual e-commerce sales of at least 10 million yuan, or at least 100 active online stores, or whose active online stores account for at least 10% of the total village households. This is a local brand of fishing gears in Hanan Village. 咱们这个一般这一个月销量得有多少啊？
现在一个月的销量就是这款鱼竿单品的话，应该在7万只左右。
就这一款就7万只。哎，对，是的，是的。在咱们当地这个村子里面吧，有90%的人都在从事电商淘宝这一块。咱们现在这个厂子里面的所有的工人都是咱们当地人，100%的咱们当地人。很重要的一点是，如果说在咱们当地上班，在挣的钱差不多的前提下，他能守着自己的家里人，守着自己的孩子，这对于他们来说，这是一种享受，我感觉。
In the village, we can see that almost all businesses are operated by family members or neighbors. They build their factory here and they just work from home. It's at such a low budget. Besides veggies and other agricultural products, they also sell clothes here in Taobao Village.
因为我们这个地区的电商比较发达，像我们的员工都是这个周边的，他们也不用出去打工了。
This whole building is designed for live stream. They're doing live stream in each room to sell their products, clothes, t-shirt, hoodie online. Let's have a look. Because of these Taobao villages here, they have such a big delivery center to support the package express service in Suning County. In the next 10 years, it's estimated that there will be more than 20,000 Taobao villages across the country, creating more than 20 million job opportunities to attract more young people to their hometown to start businesses.
How many of you want to live in a tiny house off-grid? Capture your own rainwater in a huge rain catchment system. Run all of your electricity needs completely off solar. Finance your land for 10 years and get it paid off quicker if possible. Yes, there's still going to be land taxes. Welcome to America. But your cost of living is almost going to be nothing compared to what you're paying now. I still ain't bought into the electric car thing yet. So some of the big questions are, how did you do it? How do you live off-grid? Okay, so what did I do? How did I do it? In 2013, I got online and I started looking for land for sale. What I was really looking for was off-grid land or just hunting land. It didn't take long and I found some desert land in West Texas that was really cheap. After doing a little investigation on the rainfall only being about 12 inches a year, I decided against that and I figured out that's pretty much why the property was so cheap. So I literally Googled up, where's the best place to live off-grid in the United States? Not only did I find what I was looking for, I was told the counties that were the best in the United States to go off-grid in. Okay, Google, good off-grid property in this certain county. And guess what I found? We finance land ourselves, in-house finance. No credit, bad credit, nothing needed, just your down payment. So being a man with bad credit at the time, what do you think I did? So I got on their website and I looked up the counties I was talking about. Found several properties in those counties. And you know, a lot of this stuff is old logging land that had already been logged. I mean, it didn't bother me. It was beautiful. The owners of the company and the property were so nice that they said, if you want to and you have an RV or a tent or something like that, you can actually go out there and pitch your tent or pull your RV out there and stay a few days and see how you like it. See if you want to buy it. Well, I know this part right here doesn't sound good if you got good credit, but it sounds great if you were in a situation like I was in. 10% annual interest. If you do the math on that and you understand what that is, it's kind of tough, but I did it. 10 years has gone by. I've done a whole lot of improvements, and I paid it off. Not only did I pay it off, I put that tiny house on it, and I did a bunch of... So I did a bunch of other things that was good for a hunting property. And I thought, man, if things ever went bad in the United States and we went to war or we had civil unrest or anything like that, my property would be the perfect place to be. I'm glad I got this thing. So that was my kind of train of thought. Needless to say, I eventually paid it off. I got the deed. And I know you're like, well, how can I do this? Okay, well, first off, you have to pick what state you want to be in and what state you want to do this in. Second off, I would do my research on what states have the least regulations of living off-grid, which states will actually let you capture rainwater, which states will actually let you use solar panels, which states will actually let you dig your own well if you desire to. Did I mention which state has the lowest property taxes? Look, man, I'm not saying I did it perfect. I'm not even saying I did it the way you would do it. What I'm saying is, this is how I did it, and this is a way that you can try for yourself. When I made the short video about it, it was blowing up, and it still is blowing up. And that's the reason why I'm making this video here, because I want to answer some of y'all's questions that you have. I mean, I don't want this all to my own. If this can help somebody out, I mean, I want other people to do the same thing. I want other people to live their life, have a good life. You work 30, 35 years to pay off a house, a mortgage nowadays. And then you pay $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 a year in taxes for that house after it's paid. Seems like a lot of times it's people's dream to just have a small cabin out on a bunch of acreage. Or just to have a small cabin out on 5 acres. People would be happy with that. That's what I keep hearing anyways. Now let's get into some of the details of how I did it. Okay, true story. A lot of you didn't believe, but this house cost me right at $8,400. I went and I paid cash for it. I bought a travel trailer for $3,000. I fixed it up and I turned it for $8,500. So I went straight down and bought this house. This house was a shell. It has no interior. It's just a shell, if you know what that is. Now I'm going to show you where you get these type of houses. Do you ever look on the side of the road and you see those shed to house type things? Or even you see buildings like Graceland or, you know, places where you see them building a shed. And usually it's in the county and they've got them lined up on some property and you're driving down the highway and you see a few of them lined up out there for sale. Well, that's what we kind of got going on here. I'm not saying that you can get this house for $8,400 anymore. That was 2 years ago. But you might be able to get one similar like it for about $10,000 or $12,000. You don't have to have credit to get one of these, and you don't have to have the cash to get one. They let you make payments on them. You just put a down payment, and they'll deliver it. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not even saying that you have to live off-grid. But you can buy a property like this, and you can have it as a hunting property, and you can just keep it for hunting. And I guess if things went bad and, you know, that SHTF thing happens, I guess you could go out there and take your family out there and maybe prepare in that kind of sense, you know. So what is the status of my batteries now at about 3 p.m.? Let's check it out and see. I don't know if you can see it or if there's too much of a glare, but it says 329 watts are coming in and the batteries are in float, sitting at 6.1 amps. 54 volts is where it's at. It's basically telling us that the house is being ran completely off of the solar panels right now, and we're only pulling 328 watts, and the batteries are just totally topped off. They're sitting here totally floating. Nothing's being pulled from the batteries. Everything that's being pulled in the house, like the refrigerator and the fan and the other things, electric water pump and all that, whenever it turns on, all those things are being ran right now by the solar panels themselves.
A few people have been asking, will it run the air conditioner? Yes, it'll run the air conditioner, especially during the daytime. It has no problem at all running the air conditioner. The air conditioner pulls about 550 watts, and we're bringing in 3,200 watts when we need it. So, yeah. It has no problem running the refrigerator, the air conditioner, the fan, and several other things. Whatever you want to run, it'll run. I run my power tools when I'm out working. I run my shop and my shop lights and any tools that I have in the shop. So, yeah, I'm not going to lie. It's a peaceful place to be. And it's a nice place to call home. It's a nice place to kick back and relax. It's a beautiful day out here today. The wife's not here today. I kind of wish she was. She would enjoy this weather. A lot of people keep asking about that garden. Yes, I want to do a garden someday. Yes, but I don't have a garden yet. I don't have animals yet and all that. And yes, someday I want to have animals, especially chickens and things like that where we can have our own eggs. But I'm just not to that point yet.
Okay, let's check out some details on my rainwater catchment system. So this is the 6,000-gallon water tank that I harvest the rainwater in. I got this tank on a trade for a golf cart for $200. I towed it about 250 miles on a 16-foot trailer. These are the gutters and the gutter guards, which you can see are clearly doing their job this year. And this is where it comes together and runs into the tank. On the back side of the water tank here is the water pump house. This has my pump, filter, and water pressure tank inside it. The small black tank that you see is a 500-gallon overflow tank. This water tank full would weigh about 40,000 pounds. I shock it twice a year with about 4 gallons of bleach each time, depending on how much rain has been flowing through it. I installed the wood stove in this chimney pipe. I got the wood stove used for about $200. The chimney parts were really expensive. They cost me about $600, and I mean, this is me doing all this myself.
I appreciate all y'all watching. If you do leave a comment, I answer almost every one of them back. The rude and crude ones, I don't really answer back, but I like to answer back to everybody and talk to everybody and stay interactive with everybody. So if you want to leave a comment, more than likely I'm going to respond to you. Okay, guys, until next time, we'll see you later.
You want your own piece of land? You want to live in the country? You tired of the city life? The stress of all those bills? Stick around, because this may be what you're looking for. First thing you need to do is buy some land. I bought my land cheap. It's 30 acres, and it's beautiful. I had somebody finance it, and I had bad credit. It was easy. It was what they call in-house finance. It's kind of like when you get a car from a buy here, pay here. So here's the deal. I bought this land from a company that sells off-grid property. I wanted it off-grid because I didn't want bills, and I wanted to be away from the city, and I wanted my own land, a piece of land that I actually owned. I didn't have the money to build a house on this property. And plus, remember, I didn't have any credit. So I moved this camper on my property, and that's what I stayed in. The roads weren't very good when I got here, but now they're pretty nice. I put this gate up here at the front of the property to keep the bad guys out. I made these roads up through here so I could have access to the place I wanted to build my house. I sold some stuff, saved up $8,000, and bought this shed. I started working on the inside to make it into a home. First, I put in all the electric. I ran the wiring from the breaker box to all the plug receptacles. And then I wired in these lights. I did insulation, ran all these water lines, put in a nice large shower. I even made my own toilet. You put the bag in the bucket and close the lid. Put in this instant hot water heater and made sure we're going to have hot water. Started putting up the sheetrock. We put in these cabinets, built this matching little bar here in the center. I installed this wood-burning stove to keep us warm in the wintertime. This is my 6,000-gallon water tank that's filled up by the rain gutters. Built this pump house behind it for the pump and the filtration system. Now we have water like a normal household. I designed this do-it-yourself solar system to run the entire cabin. This is the battery shed. And that's my battery bank. It's what runs the house at night when there's no solar power. This is the inverter by EG4 that powers up the whole house. Really wasn't too hard. I did a little bit of studying online. I got on some of the solar forums when I needed to ask questions. And boom, there it was. My first solar system only cost me around $3,400. The lead acid battery bank that I have, I'm gonna keep going with that for now. Soon I'll be upgrading to the new lithium batteries, which will last much longer. They're really starting to get cheap. You can still find landowner finance. It's gonna be a little more expensive than when I bought it, and you're probably going to need about 12% down. No credit or bad credit should be just fine. You want to make sure you find a place that has no covenants, no homeowner associations, and no restrictions, provided you're wanting to live off of the grid. You really want land way out into the country if you want to be self-sufficient like this. You're not going to get in trouble for building your own solar power where I'm at. And no laws against catching rainwater. And where I'm at so far up here into the mountains, there is no trash pickup. I know you guys hate this, but it is legal for me to burn my trash in my state. It's all paid for. There's no rent, no electric bill, no land payment. And if I plowed my own garden, I may disappear for good. Y'all are going to trip out when you see this. Found this dog on the side of the road earlier. What are you so happy about? If you're interested in this lifestyle or you want to know more about it, just leave a comment. I can answer most of your questions. And I left a link for some of the solar equipment. I definitely keep insurance. I pay an internet bill and a phone bill. I mean, come on, I wouldn't be able to do my YouTube videos.
Hi folks, in this video I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas, and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now, I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively, and you can do this at an age, at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on, with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. I mean, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look. Last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been. And has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots? And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time. And he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 a piece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
She a dude. She just hit you in your face. She a dude. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh, oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She feel like you a motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't. That nigga hurting himself.
You from New State.
It's over. It's over. All I say is over. Everybody get the fuck out of here.
Man, fuck it. Let's go across the street.
I ain't caught it. I'll slap the fuck out of one of y'all. Real quick.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you can do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns, because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations, like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield? See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that, because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-WAC movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them, which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place. There's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you gotta own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
Bye. Today's podcast is titled How to Build a Room. Now, I figure before you learn how to build, tackle a house, learn how to build a room, because a house, be it big, small, or tiny, is a collection of rooms. So we're debuting that, and we also break that down to how to, well, in addition to how to build a room, how to build a floor, how to build a ceiling, you know, including materials needed and things of that nature. Then on Monday, we're working on a major announcement of a project which includes how to build a room and the time, everything else we've been talking about. But that will be audios into the real life. So, where are we here? Okay. Because my phone was. Oh, man, wait a minute. I got to respond to, wait a minute. Let's do a quick musical interlude so I can answer this email regarding Monday. We'll be right back. Church and steeple. Okay, so we're working on a major project here, which I'll probably kind of reach out to some of you over the weekend and what it's concerning, but then Monday we'll just announce what people are calling me. I got to decline that call. So, look, anyway, let me get to this project here. We'll talk talk to some of you over the weekend, and then we'll make the announcement officially, if there is one, hopefully there will be, on this coming Monday. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.